Thank you. Good morning, church.
Good morning.
Lovely to see you all in Sunday worship this morning. I pray that you have been blessed beyond measure already. At this point, before we release the Sunday school kids and the teens, last week we started a new series entitled These Streets. The idea was to look at the three categories that are mentioned in the Bible and in sociology and just by anecdotal observance by the layman. And those three categories are the poor and disenfranchised, the homeless, they end up on the streets. The dangerous, they end up on the streets and they could affect you and harm you. Is that Alistair Buchanan I see? Welcome to you, sir. Always a pleasure to have you with us. And then last but not least, there's also the sexually trafficked or the sexually dysfunctional. That could include just straight dysfunction or actually trafficked. And kind of pushed into a certain mode of action. And so last week, the dangers was represented by ex-gangster and part of the Stachy clan. The last two remaining brothers were here, and Sally Stachy shared his testimony as to how he came out of that entire system and how the Lord saved him and is now using him in this current day. He's a member at Batsud Baptist just down the road and doing great work there. We use him on and off again in certain contexts. Today we are going to be focusing on sexual slavery and human trafficking. And we've got Griselda Grootboom who's going to do a testimony, but it's digital. So we did the testimony in the week. We've edited it. It's over an hour long and you'll view it, after which I will then do a very short follow-up sermon on that. Due to the theme of it, we are going to release the Sunday school. Now, last week they stayed, but Sunday school and teens, you can now go to your various destinations. Thank you. Nehemi, are we all ready to roll? Just also, by the way, today's the first time in a long time. We met with some of our older folk yesterday, Saturday afternoon, after the funeral. And I spoke to one or two of the ladies there, and they were saying they don't come to the congregational Sunday worship gathering, but they do watch the service at home. And they notice only the sermon is being live streamed. And the one says, I don't want to just hear you, I want to hear everybody and see everybody. And so for the first time in a long while, we are broadcasting or live streaming the entire service from beginning all the way to the end. So yes, if you do stand in the camera's purview, please make sure that everything is neat, ironed, and tidy. Folks, I've already kind of set up the clip that you're going to see. Some of the stuff is harrowing. It's not done in bad taste, but you can't get away from the traumatic nature of what you're about to hear. And the very idea is that it does impact you, does affect you. If I could, I would. I would take you on a tour of the underbelly of Cape Town City, where you see the dark side of Cape Town. You might not come back the same. Seeing it, where the gangsterism, the prostitution, the drug deals, and all those type of things take place. But this is a brief view into that world, after which I'm going to pray and then preach, hopefully, some type of a remedy and a solution from God's word. God bless you. Thank you, Nehemi. You can roll the clip.
My name is Griselda Grootboom. My family was one of those happy grandmother with my father, not my mother, the uncles and the aunties, and it was just your typical, home. And, stuff started to happen, tragedy started to happen. My grandfather passed away, then my grandmother, and through that time was at the same time where the community was, you know, taking up development, new leadership politically. It was in a very much time of you know, Black people, colored people coming out of apartheid and you just falling through the gaps of new developments. So my family was one of those people, and my dad became very used to on substance abuse, you know, because our grandparents, no work. And then this new structure was taking place in our community where you lose your house and get put in a box. And, you know, my dad didn't bother with that procedure because of, I think, you know, trauma. Sometimes we think our Black families don't go through trauma, with what we learn today is, you know, this generation of what, wow, this is what the system actually holds. And, you know, I had to learn how to survive on the streets from the age of 8 with my dad. And he used to just go to the streets, the docks, try to get fish, salad. And then sometimes also just leave me at an adult's shelter, pay for it. But then, you know, I was a kid, so all I knew was like, you need to be with family. So I was always running away from the shelter and ended up joining the rest of the kids under the bridge in Cape Town. From the age of 8, I had to learn extremely quickly of you, the people that surround you are the only family members, and the way they live and the lifestyle, it's the only survival on the streets. You don't have a roof, there's no parents, there's nothing. I tried to tap into my mom's life, which was married with a Xhosa guy, and it's a very taboo thing if you a Xhosa woman and have a kid from outside back then. Patriarchy and the marriage institutions that would, like, in the Xhosa tribe would just really shame and disgrace you. So my mom never welcomed me, and she was like, ugh, I'm one of her uncle's kids. It's such a burden mode. And in that time being in Khayelitsha Site C, that's when the whole experience of culture change, and I had to learn Xhosa from Afrikaans, the environment. I didn't have much time to be taken to school. I had to work a lot. And then in that same time, that's when I got gang raped, like for the first time at the age of 8. And in the Xhosa Khayelitsha, it was called a norm. It had a name, Ifoli. So people knew about these boys just gang raping girls. And when you take it up, it was the typical hush hush thingy. And I just remember that day when we were waiting for our turn to get, you know, water, because it was one tip. And these guys, you know, with the knife against my waist, and it's another girl, and just walked up with us. And these are guys that we see in our community that we used to greet. And that aggressiveness looked very social, and it's like we wanted to be there. And they took turns the whole day. Like, yeah. It was an experience where you... them taking time and the threats, and I got just told to leave the house in the evening, I think just after parents come home. That was like late. And when I walked into my street, you know, I could pick up that my mom has been looking for me and was blamed that I'm outside and about as a young teenage girl. And when I walked in the house, she just beat me up. She never bothered to ask where I've been. Like, the house haven't been cleaned all day. And the anger in me started so much. I just got so angry, so angry. And I just couldn't wait for the next day. And the next day I just took my jacket and I went back to the streets. And that was like the beginning of just being angry and knowing that you're not worthy of anything. You're just an outcast. So when families from churches would come and say, hey, we would like to have a weekend over with a kid, and funny enough, we'd actually really behave and sober up, because, wow, that is the greatest dream child feeling you get. And we had a lot of cell group moments from churches that spend time with us. So we got to know what the, not to be mean to God right now, but the doctrine of the Bible and the doctrine system of church. You go to church, you come back, these are the songs, these are the songs that you sing. And sometimes that was a good feel for you for a moment to carry you through, you know, going back. And the question was always to ask, like, but why can't we have that kind of life? And that is what we had being street kids and shelter kids. And I always say to people when I have talks, like, you'd be surprised about the things these kids talk about. You know, they don't talk about what's the next break in. They actually talk about how much we desire to be in family homes and have a family life. For me, it was that loyalty friendship that grew strong between the two of us. That same year of me getting kicked out is the same year that she was going to travel, go to Joburg. Her family was moving. And I was like, listen, you know, give me a number. So when I get kicked out, at least I can, you know, maybe try to come to Joburg. I'll see and change my life better that time because nobody knows anything. And of course, we did that exchange. And then, you know, the first tragedy in the shelter happened when one of my best friends got stoned to death on Lion's Head and raped. And we just started to feel like, wow, the streets are really becoming dangerous for us now as street kids. And then at night, I would stand on those top robots close to, you know, those universities where I would stand at the robots and ask for money so I can collect money to take the train. And, you know, the desperation that pedophiles sort of took advantage of, where some of these lecturers would in the middle of the night say, okay, but I'm going to give you this money, what are you going to give me? So it would be like, you need to give him what sexual he wants to have with you. And it was, that's how I collected my money. And then I took the train to Johannesburg, and it took at least about, I think, 2 to 3 days. Back then the trains were really slow. And taking the train in third class, one thing we learned was you always stay awake because you're a girl. Most of the time I had to look like a tomboy not to get raped or robbed, and very high so that you don't fall asleep. And eventually got to Joburg, gave her a call and told her what I was dressed in, and she would meet me at the certain area on Park Station. She did that, and I was so excited. You know when you see your friend, you're like, oh, yes. But then it was like, whoa, okay. This whole feeling, she's changed, and she's with this car and getting the car, we need to go. And I'm like, okay, it's good to see you. But the exchange of greetings was just, okay, Griselda, you just need to keep quiet. You are the beggar here. You don't even have a place to stay. This is a new environment, and maybe this kind of life is this how you behave. We drove to Yeovil, walked into an apartment. I still remember so clearly, like, it smelled so fresh and clean. Like, it had wooden floors, and I was like, wow, my life is about to change. Like, I'm finally going to sleep in my own room. And I knew, like, with her, because she had everything, and I knew I'm not going to be homeless again. So this is going to be a whole change for me. And walking in the room where she said, this is where you're going to sleep, there was nothing. And I was like, I'm not going to ask questions, because she just also just moved up. And knowing that it took me so long to get here, let me take a nap. And she said she'll get me food. And that was sort of the last time I saw her. I was woken up by three guys speaking foreign language and kicking and dressing me, you know. And for me, it was, what is happening? Is the same thing happening to her? Am I going to get killed? And just when they injected me with the injection behind my knees to sort of make my lower body numb, I was like thinking, okay, I'm probably going to get cut off in pieces now, or I'm not aware. But then I feel that this breeze on my body, because my clothes are being taken off at the same time, I was like, okay. And then they gave me a drug, ecstasy, cocaine. And I was just laying there thinking, this is what I deserve in every change I'm trying to make, basically. And here I am, 18, tried very hard, you know. No time wasted. A guy came in, the sound of money exchange took place, and he just started, you know, touching me, moving me around, and doing all sorts of pleasure on my body. And this went on like for every day. Sometimes in the morning, early hours of the morning, sometimes weekend. It was like a lot. I lost count because every breath I was trying to take was me counting, basically. Just counting and then gasps for air. And then I got thrown out of the house smelling like semen, looking like a drug addict, feeling cold, feeling warm. And then I was just gasping for air, and I was like, okay, you need to get back to your street life survival, you know, like an animal, and try to find your way back. And I walked with a homeless trolley push old guy, which is one of the things we've always learned, is that, you know, if you don't want to get busted, walk with those people and shove your stuff in their bags and have this conversation and buy them hot chips or something. But I just walked with him, and, you know, and I was like, listen, I'm going to Park Station. And it's so funny, this old man was like literally lecturing me, like a father, like, you kids just don't know Joburg, you know, in a language. And I was like, are you serious right now? Okay, you know, you're my safety map right now. And we walked all the way back to Park Station. So confused, so lost, so angry. So addicted and craving for the next fix. Park Station looked so busy at that time. It was truck drivers, because, you know, it was the biggest truck stop. It was women of all kinds dressed up. It was small little taverns. There was a lot of taxis. It was just men walking around, and there were obviously pimps. And it's like the territory is known that you're walking in here as a young 18-year-old, and you just come from a certain area, and you look so drugged up. Do you need help? And, you know, the truck drivers would call out for you. So I just got into one that called me first and gave him what he wanted. And I got out and looked for a pimp and got drugs and took it from there. And the pimp, of course, introduced me to more drugs so he can keep me and start exploiting me. Sometimes we would be locked up in houses to shoot sort of porn movies that we were not even aware of, but you are kept there for a week. Sometimes we get threatened by the drug dealers that are the same people, which are the pimps, to sit in dirty drains with the drugs and after the police have finished raiding. So you were constantly dirty. Like, you were just dirty. There were times where you have a morning opportunity to tap into society by going to the clinic and saying, I need assistance because there's just an aroma that's not right. And I think it's because of 1, 2, 3 condoms are stuck up me, or a sponge or a small tiny pad. And I need some cleaning. And you get discriminated from those same individuals. So when people ask the question, the system, I'm like, whoa, have you tried the system in grassroots? Like, have you lived through the system on grassroots system and tasted the communication skills and tasted the treatment of you not knowing who you are, you not having a document, you not having a spouse to vouch for you. And when you go for a reach out, it was just insane. And then eventually my pimp swapped me with a Port Elizabeth madam, and they did a swap through Drag More Girls. And in Port Elizabeth, I worked when I was like 20, you know, in my 20s, and worked for a year in the brothel. It was owned by a white lady, and it was owned by a gentleman of her husband. And he was from the South African Defense Force, big, tall Afrikaans guy. And he made sure, like, this is his brothel, you know, you're not going to come and steal his clients. And that means, like, he could literally just torture you. And after that, give you, you know, 2 bags of cocaine so you can just keep quiet and get back to work. And getting pregnant, my madam was like, oh, okay, well, you know, you're a black girl, your market was not really good, so you are gonna be going on shifts until you go to 6 months or something, because the men love the pressure of the baby in your private part. They're enjoying the fantasy. So basically every day while I was pregnant, I was still being enslaved in the brothel to give service to men that pays for my body. And in this 6 months, the bond was just starting to grow with me and this baby. And it was this hope of escape for me that she's going to throw me out. And that didn't happen. She called an in-house doctor that was obviously a client to do an in-house abortion. And I think that day, that was the day when, I don't know, warfare of salvation of my soul, mind and body was happening on that table. It was, you know, it was at the back where makeup, and I was laying there and I was given a tablet with a shot, and I was laying on the bed and the pain of the crunchiness. And I was like, okay. And I don't think he waited fully. I don't think he waited for the crunch of the abortion tablet. And when he took out Summer and me seeing Summer's feet in this bowl, it was like, what? No, I can never be this old and allow somebody do this to somebody else. You know, I felt like I wanted to defend, you know, Summer, and it was already late. Because there she was in a bowl, and I'm not going to feel that kicking anymore in something. And then, you know, 3 hours later, I was asked to just take sponges and get back to work, because it's part of my job, and that's why I was there. Stuff with drugs, thrown in a car and driven back to Johannesburg. I OD'd because of the drugs he gave me. So I looked like a prostitute that had too much drugs and passed out. And then, of course, the girls called the ambulance and I ended up in the hospital. Lost a lot of blood. I think I woke up like, you know, couple of months or so, and I was so mad that I woke up. I was like so mad at God. I was like, you are not serious. Like, seriously, you're bringing me back to hell, you know? And there's this, you know, typical individuals or prayer warriors standing next to the bed, and she's like, listen, I'm not gonna be an angel, but I'm gonna be you know, I'm going to be that person that was supposed to help you a long time ago, and I'm just going to claim you here. and say that, you know, you're one of my projects and I've done outreach with you and you've made it after this couple of months. Months and days I've been praying at your bed. So I'm just going to write a report that you need some assistance. And at that age of 20s, you know, South Africa system did not have any drug system for Black women. Prostitution was the most highest criminal law that women would find themselves enslaved in. So it was illegal. So you go to jail and you have a record that you are criminal wherever you go around the country. So it was extremely hard with my records to get that particular document, white lie from her as a woman of God and as an evangelist in hospitals, just praying for people to wake up. And I think her prayers have worked extremely a lot while I was laying there. As much as I wanted to choke her when I saw her, I was like, man, you're not even an angel. So definitely if you're going to waste my time, and I'm going to be another guinea pig. And that wasn't the case. I got assistance to stay in the shelter. I got assistance to go to rehab, which was the most suicidal time of my life, because you get to get this couple of months where things are coming out and things that was engraved in your mind and your spirits emotionally through drugs, you start dreaming about them. I mean, for me, I was extremely suicidal in rehab, and that's one thing I think our rehab houses or people who deal with drug addict individuals, you don't just deal with the medical side of this individual of how much drug they took. You also have to deal with the emotional and the spiritual, because there were times where I used to put the sheet around my neck just in case I get the dark fall dream in the hole and I can fall from the bed and maybe the sheet will choke me to death, you know. But it never happened. There were times where the nurses that came to give us medication, you just want to choke her and take all the medication so you can smoke it anyhow. But then I make it through the humanitarian circle, which you say, hi, my name is. And I made it through that session, because those circles takes a long time for addicts. You know, you are out from something in a world that, you know, you're looking at people, what the heck, who are you? And you've been with these people for months. And eventually it got to me where I could say, hi, my name is, but I didn't know what my name was. And that was like a shock to my, to me, the real me, the me that the social worker doesn't know, the me that the ambulance and police don't know. And I grew through their projects, and then I got taken to a shelter called Home of Hope, where the shelter had little kids and babies, newborn babies that were born by women that comes from prostitution, or young girls that were from prostitution and pregnant, and the pimp makes them deliver the baby somewhere in the drain or something, and then the kid is still alive. So these babies were brought to the shelter, and we had to serve in the shelter because we were too old to be in shelters, and there were no shelter for older women. And I remember these babies coming in, and like, you know, there would be maybe once a month a baby that would bring in that literally, like, this baby is like 12 hours just born right now. So you need to be this loving hands and caring that this human being can grow and understand that they're in earth. And I remember rocking one of the babies to sleep, and this kid smiling. I was like, what? I don't have that human feeling. How can you smile in your sleep in these arms, you know? Everything for me was survival. There was no thought of love or Christ or care. It was survival. So when this baby gave me this bonding moment of, it was like, wow, God is just too much. He's just still there, and I didn't like God. It was just all survival, you know. I learned churches were a good place for you to go through their system to survive, to get food, to get a place to sleep. If you behave churchy, you're going to get church help. And this time it was for them to use me as a drug trafficking mole, where I had to cook, pack, and deliver. And I did that, and I ended up in one church where, wow, where I was approached by one of the pastors to come and drop drugs aside. And I knew that this is the opportunity to escape, because he wasn't in the circle of the pimps that I knew in Johannesburg or Berea or Hillbury Oval. And I took that opportunity, and I was like, God, these people are using your name, so I'm going to use your name to escape. And when I get to Cape Town, I swear, so I'm going to go straight home. And yeah, go through a moment of trying to help myself get myself back to normal. My battle in deliverance and getting out was health, was love, home, family. And I think holding on to what I knew about God and what the Bible, what I had, a small little blue black Bible from Salvation Army, and reading it and crying on top of it. And like, okay, God, but like, what's the deal? Dude, really, this is hard. We shot the movie, and then, of course, the movie was launched in Summerstown with all stakeholders and NGOs and government departments officials. And I was in this room so angry again. I was angry because, wow, all of these people are here for this individual issue that I have been through 18 years of my life, and not one of them came to rescue me, you know? And I was asked as the leading star, like, Chris Alder, what's your feel about this movie? How do you think this movie will really help victims and survivors? And I was like, you know what? I don't know, because I feel like the women in the Bible that was brought by the exact individuals into space to condemn, that it's her fault. It's her fault that she was prostituted. It was her fault that she was raped. It's because she liked it. It's because the way she dressed. It's because the way, the kind of family or how she comes out from, you know. And of course, I said, I'm a survivor of it. And that's where I got the first opportunity to exit from the long trauma, mentally, emotionally, of the sex slave trade. The author of the book called Exit. I'm also a, you know, global survivor leader on human trafficking and drug trafficking, and also exited from prostitution, which is what I do today as a human rights activist, and you know, doing a lot of changing the law against legalization of prostitution, and also bringing awareness and interventions on sex trafficking and human trafficking. Yeah, that's me.
I'm going to shock you. I've got 10 minutes. And part of that 10, I know what you've seen is quite shocking, especially if you're not exposed to just even a little bit, a subsection of the reality that millions of people in this country go through. Griselda went through three major categories: sexual dysfunction, poverty, as well as drug misuse and abuse. Some people go through one of those three. She went through all three of it. About 2 months ago, I was standing in this pulpit and I couldn't read. And I said, someone sort the lights out, please, there's something wrong. After 2 months of the same, I've got reading glasses. Getting old, y'all. So I want to just share a few thoughts from Joshua, chapter 2, which is Rahab and the spies. I'll read as follows, just to... I can't see weather glasses on you. I can only see the words. I'll take it off intermittent. I'm still getting used to this whole routine. Please forgive me. I'll read the entire chapter. Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. I always feel like I'm sinning when I say that. Go look over the land, he said, especially Jericho. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. The king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab, bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, they left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax she had laid out on the roof. So the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. So she let them down by a rope through the window, for the house she lived in was part of the city wall. She said to them, go to the hills so the pursuers will not find you. Hide yourselves there 3 days until they return, and then go on your way. Now the men had said, this oath you made us swear will not be binding on us, unless when we enter the land, you have tied this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless you have brought your father and mother, your brothers, and all your family into your house. If any of them go outside your house into the street, their blood will be on their own heads. We will not be responsible. As for those who are in the house with you, their blood will be on our head if a hand is laid on them. But if you tell what we are doing, we will be released from the oath you made us swear. Agreed, she replied. Let it be as you say. So she sent them away and departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. When they left, But anyway, when they left, they went into the hills and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers searched all along the road and returned without finding them. Then the two men started back. They went down out of the hills, forded the river, and came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him everything that had happened to them. They said to Joshua, the Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting in fear because of us. Just a few thoughts I want to share with you before time disappears for us. The first thing is, in verse, this latter part of verse 1, it says, so they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. It's important in the biblical record and the narrative, the point that they're trying to make, which is God saves and God uses people who are not saved. To that leads us to a greater point, that God is bigger than you think. I'm going to share with you a story that's got nothing to do with sexual trafficking and nothing to do with drug abuse and nothing to do with the streets, but it has a significant point to make about the power of God. Years ago, we were a young couple. We had just started our previous ministry, our church. I think there was -4 people that were coming. And we had this one cell group to this lady who opened up a home, and a few weeks later, another one that started opposite, like a Bible study in this home. And the couple, it was a combined meeting this night, didn't come over like they should. But as we're sitting, sharing the word of God, I hear, because the house is like right opposite, I hear like plates breaking and I hear shouting. So there's obviously a domestic disturbance happening there. And so eventually I say, guys, you continue reading these notes. I'm going to go over there and see what's happening in this house. Because obviously we can all hear something is happening. And it is a domestic abuse and so forth. And at this point, I'm alone when I go over. And I get in there, and the wife of the house, thankfully the kids are not there. The wife tells me, please help me. My man is possessed. Now, I'm not here to talk about the theological position of oppression versus possession and all those type of things. But he was lying on the floor. He was... Oh, you sorry, I wasn't alone. She was with me. So, oh, you were the wife. Thank you. But so before we get to that part, there's all nonsense happening. And eventually Jareen goes in with the wife in the room, and I'm left alone with this guy. And I just start praying. I don't know how I'm praying, I'm just praying. That morning, I'll never forget, all I did was prepare the Bible study. I didn't have my own personal quiet time. Have you ever been so busy that you forget to pray and connect with God Himself? You just do the work of the ministry, but the Lord of that work, you've overlooked. And that was me that day. And I felt woefully unholy, unprepared, and unqualified to deal with Satan incarnate over here. And I remember at one point I'm praying out loud, and this guy is next to me, and I put my hand on his shoulder, because he's kneeling like in a fetal position, but upright. And I've got my hand on his shoulder, and he starts to rise up. And it was the most strange sensation, because I can feel he was a smaller guy than I was, but the muscles are just starting to begin to get shredded, and almost like feel like it's getting, and he's getting bigger, and he's looking up at me like that, and he's just standing up, and I'm like, you know, no matter what I'm rebuking there or whatever, this is not working. And eventually he comes up and he looks at me. And again, I'm thinking, right, this is it. I'm going to get at least beaten. I'm done for, because I didn't have my quiet time this morning. And I kid you not, he turns and he goes right back down. And I say, what's going on? In fact, I'm vulnerable at this point. And he says, there's a light coming from you and it's forcing me down. And I'm thinking, it's certainly not me. And at that point, I know that it's Jesus. This God that I serve is bigger than me. And I want to apply that to you as well. The God that we serve is bigger than our sense and sensibilities. Because sometimes we get this idea, now don't get me wrong, I'm not becoming amoral or immoral. I'm simply becoming bigger than our morals. That God can use people that we have written off. God can even use you when you've been written off. And we know this is a biblical fact. Time after time in the Old Testament, God is raising up an unholy, disparate king to be his beating stick to Israel or to some other nation that is judging. It appears that God can use whomever, whenever he wants. And here he uses Rahab. And they call her a prostitute, not because they want to define her, but because this narrative of God being bigger than who you think he is being established. God will even use a prostitute. I want to say, I don't know what your thoughts are about yourself, because Griselda had some bad thoughts about herself. And that was, of course, established by environment, by her family, and by those around her. I want to say, as bad as you are, God can use you. As good as you are, you can mess up. And so, don't find confidence in your flesh, good or bad. Don't find confidence in your maintaining of a morality. We should. It's Christ-honoring to maintain a Christian morality, but don't put your faith there, put